Chapter 94. That plagiarism farce. As if there was much of anything in any human utterance, oral or written, except plagiarism. The kernel, the soul, let us go further, and say the substance, the bulk, the actual and valuable material of all human utterances is plagiarism. For substantially all ideas are second-hand, consciously and unconsciously drawn from a million outside sources, and daily used by the garnerer with a pride and satisfaction born of the superstition that he originated them, whereas there is not a rag of originality about them anywhere except the little discoloration they get from his mental and moral caliber and his temperament, and which is revealed in characteristics of phrasing. When a great orator makes a great speech, you are listening to 10 centuries and 10,000 men, but we call it a speech, and really some exceedingly small portion of it is his, but not enough to signify. It is merely a Waterloo. It is Wellington's battle, in some degree, and we call it his, but there are others that contributed. It takes 1,000 men to invent a telegraph, or a steam engine, or a phonograph, or a photograph, or a telephone or any other important thing, and the last man gets the credit, and we forget the others. He added his little mite, that is all he did. These object lessons should teach us that 99 parts of all things that proceed from the intellect are plagiarisms, pure and simple, and the lesson ought to make us modest. But nothing can do that. Then why don't we unwittingly reproduce the phrasing of a story, as well as the story itself? It can hardly happen to the extent of 50 words except in the case of a child. Its memory tablet is not lumbered with impressions, and the actual language can have craving room there, and preserve the language a year or two, but a grown person's memory tablet is a palimpsest, with hardly a bare space upon which to engrave a phrase. It must be a very rare thing that a whole page gets so sharply printed upon a man's mind by a single reading that it will stay long enough to turn up some time or other and be mistaken by him for his own. No doubt we are constantly littering our literature with disconnected sentences borrowed from books at some unremembered time and now imagined to be our own, but that is about the most we can do. In 1866 I read Dr. Holmes' poems in the Sandwich Islands. A year and a half later I stole his dictation, without knowing it, and used it to dedicate my Nos in Se Broadwith. Then years afterwards I was talking with Dr. Holmes about it. He was not an ignorant ass, no, not he. He was not a collection of decayed human turnips, like your plagiarism court. And so when I said, I know now where I stole it, but whom did you steal it from? He said, I don't remember. I only know I stole it from somebody, because I have never originated anything altogether myself, nor met anybody who had. To think of those solemn donkeys breaking a little child's heart with their ignorant rubbish about plagiarism. I couldn't sleep for blaspheming about it last night. Why, their whole lives, their whole histories, all their learning, all their thoughts, all their opinions were one solid ruck of plagiarism, and they didn't know it, and never suspected it. A gang of dull and hoary pirates piously setting themselves the task of disciplining and purifying a kitten that they think they've caught filching a chop. Oh, damn, but you finish it, dear, I am running short of vocabulary today. Ever lovingly your friend, Mark. Edited and modified by Clara Clemens, deputy to her mother, who for more than 7 months has been ill in bed, and unable to exercise her official function. The burden of the Clemens household had fallen almost entirely upon Clara Clemens. In addition to supervising its customary affairs, she also shouldered the responsibility of an unusual combination of misfortunes. For besides the critical condition of her mother, her sister, John Clemens, was down with pneumonia, no word of which must come to Mrs. Clemens. Certainly it was a difficult position. In some account of it, which he set down later, Clemens wrote, "It was fortunate for us all that Clara's reputation for truthfulness was so well established in her mother's mind. It was our daily protection from disaster. The mother never doubted Clara's word. Clara could tell her large improbabilities without exciting any suspicion, whereas if I tried to market even a small and simple one, the case would have been different. I was never able to get a reputation like Clara's. The accumulation of physical ailments in the Clemens home had somewhat modified Mark Twain's notion of medical practice. He was no longer radical, he had become eclectic. It is a good deal of a concession that he makes to Twitchell, after those earlier letters from Sweden, in which osteopathy had been heralded as the anodyne for all human ills. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. Dear Joe, Livy does really make a little progress these past 3 or 4 days, progress which is visible to even the untrained eye. The physicians are doing good work with her, but my notion is that no art of healing is the best for all ills. I should distribute the ailments around. Surgery cases to the surgeons, lupus to the actinic ray specialist, nervous prostration to the Christian Scientist, most ills to the allopath and the homeopath. In my own particular case, rheumatism, gout and bronchial attacks to the osteopathist. Mr. Rogers was to sail southward this morning and here is this weather. I am sorry. I think it's a question if he gets away tomorrow. Is ever Mark. It was through J.Y. M. McAllister, to whom the next letter is written, that Mark Twain had become associated with the Plasmon Company, which explains the reference to pears. He had seen much of McAllister during the winter at Tedworth Square, and had grown fond of him. It is a characteristic letter, and one of interesting fact. To J.Y. M. McAllister, in London. Riverdale, New York. April 7, 03. Dear McAllister, yours arrived last night, and God knows I was glad to get it, for I was afraid I had blundered into an offense in some way, and forfeited your friendship, a kind of blunder I have made so many times in my life, that I am always standing in a waiting and morbid dread of its occurrence. 3 days ago I was in condition during one horribly long night to sympathetically roast with you in your hell of troubles. During that night I was back again, where I was in the black days, when I was buried under a mountain of debt. I called the daughters to me in private counsel, and paralyzed them with the announcement, our outgo has increased in the past 8 months until our expenses are now 125% greater than our income. It was a mistake. When I came down in the morning a gray and aged wreck, and went over the figures again, I found that in some unaccountable way, unaccountable to a businessman, but not to me, I had multiplied the totals by 2. By God, I dropped 75 years on the floor where I stood. Do you know it affected me as one is affected, when he wakes out of a hideous dream and finds that it was only a dream? It was a great comfort and satisfaction to me to call the daughters to a private meeting of the board again and say, you need not worry anymore. Our outgo is only a third more than our income. In a few months your mother will be out of her bed, and on her feet again, then we shall drop back to normal, and be all right. Certainly there is a blistering and awful reality about a well-arranged unreality. It is quite within the possibilities that 2 or 3 nights like that night of mine could drive a man to suicide. He would refuse to examine the figures, they would revolt him so, and he could go to his death unaware that there was nothing serious about them. I cannot get that night out of my head, it was so vivid, so real, so ghastly. In any other year of these 33 the relief would have been simple. Go where you can cut your cloth to fit your income. You can't do that when your wife can't be moved, even from one room to the next. Clam spells the trained nurse afternoons. I am allowed to see Mrs. Clemens 20 minutes twice a day, and write her 2 letters a day provided I put no news in them. No other person ever sees her except the physician and now, and then a nerve specialist from New York. She saw there was something the matter that morning, but she got no facts out of me. But that is nothing, as he hasn't had anything but lies for 8 months. A fact would give her a relapse. The doctor and a specialist met in conspiracy 5 days ago, and in their belief she will by and by come out of this as good as new, substantially. They ordered her to Italy for next winter, which seems to indicate that by autumn she will be able to undertake the voyage. So Clara's writing a Florence friend to take a look round among the villas for us in the regions near that city. It seems early to do this, but Joan Bergheim thought it would be wise. He and his wife lunched with us here yesterday. They have been abroad in Havana 4 months, and they sailed for England this morning. I am enclosing an order for half of my ear, founder's shares. You are not to refuse them this time, though you have done it twice before. They are yours, not mine, and for your family's sake, if not your own, you cannot in these cloudy days renounce this property which is so clearly yours and theirs. You have been generous long enough. Be just, now to yourself. Mr. Rogers is off yachting for 5 or 6 weeks. I'll get them when he returns. The head of the house joins me in warmest greetings and remembrances to you and Mrs. McAllister. Ever yours, Mark. May 8. Great Scott! I never mailed this letter. I addressed it, put registered on it, then left it lying unsealed on the arm of my chair, and rushed up to my bed quaking with a chill. I've never been out of the bed since, oh, bronchitis, rheumatism, 2 sets of teeth aching, land, I've had a dandy time for 4 weeks. And today, great guns, one of the very worst. I'm devilish sorry, and I do apologize for, although I am not as slow as you are about answering letters, as a rule, I see where I'm standing this time. 2 weeks ago John was taken down again, this time with measles, and I haven't been able to go to her, and as he hasn't been able to come to me. But Mrs. Clemens is making nice progress, and can stand alone a moment or two at a time. Now I'll post this. Mark, the 2 letters that follow, though written only a few days apart, were separated in their arrival by a period of 7 years. The second letter was, in some way, mislaid and not mailed, and it was not until after the writer of it was dead, that it was found and forwarded. Mark Twain could never get up much enthusiasm for the writings of Scott. His praise of Quentin Durward is about the only approval he ever accorded to the works of the great romanticist. To Brander Matthews, in New York. New York City, May 4th, 03. Dear Brander, I haven't been out of my bed for 4 weeks, but well, I have been reading a good deal, and it occurs to me to ask you to sit down some time or other, when you have 8 or 9 months to spare, and jot me down a certain few literary particulars for my help and elevation. Your time need not be thrown away, for at your further leisure you can make Columbian lectures out of the results, and do your students a good turn. 1. Are there in Sir Walter's novels passages done in good English which is neither slovenly or involved? 2. Are there passages whose English is not poor, and thin and commonplace, but is of a quality above that? 3. Are there passages which burn with real fire, not punk, fox fire, make-believe? 4. Has he heroes and heroines who are not cats and caduces? 5. Has he personages whose acts and talk correspond with their characters as described by him? 6. Has he heroes and heroines whom the reader admires, and knows why? 7. Has he funny characters that are funny, and humorous passages that are humorous? 8. Does he ever chain the reader's interest, and make him reluctant to lay the book down? 9. Are there pages where he ceases from posing, ceases from admiring the placid flood and flow of his own delusions, ceases from being artificial, and is for a time, long or short, recognizably sincere and in earnest? 10. Did he know how to write English, and didn't do it, because he didn't want to? 11. Did he use the right word, only when he couldn't think of another one, or did he run, so much too wrong, because he didn't know the right one when he saw it? 13. Can you read him? And keep your respect for him? Of course a person could in his day and era of sentimentality and sloppy romantics, but land, can anybody do it today? Brander, I lie here dying, slowly dying, under the blight of Sir Walter. I have read the first volume of Rob Roy, and as far as chapter 19 of Guy Mannering, and I can no longer hold my head up nor take my nourishment. Lord, it's all so juvenile, so artificial, so shoddy, and such wax figures and skeletons and specters. Interest? Why, it is impossible to feel an interest in these bloodless shams, these milk and water humbugs. And oh, the poverty of the invention. Not poverty in inventing situations, but poverty in furnishing reasons for them. Sir Walter usually gives himself away when he arranges for a situation, elaborates, and elaborates, and elaborates, till if you live to get to it, you don't believe in it when it happens. I can't find the rest of Rob Roy, I can't stand any more Mannering, I do not know just what to do, but I will reflect, and not quit this great study rashly. He was great, in his day, and to his proper audience. And so was God in Jewish times, for that matter, but why should either of them rank high now? And do they? Honest now, do they? Damn it if I believe it. My, I wish I could see you and Lee Hunt. Backquote sincerely yours S50. Clemens. To Brander Matthews, in New York. Riverdale, May 8, 03, Mail June, 1910. Dear Brander, I'm still in bed, but the days have lost their dullness, since I broke into Sir Walter, and lost my temper. I finished Guy Mannering that curious, curious book, with its mob of squalid shadows jabbering around a single flesh and blood being, Dinmont. A book crazily put together out of the very refuse of the romance artist's stage properties, finished it, and took up Quentin Durward, and finished that. It was like leaving the dead, to mingle with the living. It was like withdrawing from the infant class in the College of Journalism, to sit under the lectures in English literature in Columbia University. I wonder who wrote Quentin Durward? Ears ever. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.